The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and this is part two of our pre-recorded holiday-based programming. And although I'm sure your questions are fascinating, please do not call in to ask them. There's nobody here. So today's episode is all about alcohol. By the time you listen to the podcast version of this show, it might be too late for some of you to fully utilize the booze-related information we so helpfully provide. But the next time you're tempted to overindulge, you may, somewhere deep in the haze of your spirit-sodden brain, remember our words. You're welcome. We have two interviews for you, and first up, we're going to talk about all the things that maybe you should have thought about in the first place. Intoxication and hangovers. We speak to Dr. Rob Tarswell, a Vancouver psychiatrist, and he completed his medical school at the University of Manitoba and his residency in psychiatry at Dalhousie in Halifax. He currently practices part-time and is back in school studying nuclear medicine at UBC. Enjoy. Hi, Rob. Thanks for being on Skeptically Speaking.
You're quite welcome.
So we're talking today about alcohol and its sometimes desirable, sometimes detrimental effects. So let's start with one glass of wine. How does that affect your body?
Well, the principal effect would be the absorption of the ethanol, of course, which rapidly finds its way to your brain. It's water-soluble, freely diffusible across the blood-brain barrier, and seems to have an impact on what we call GABAergic neurotransmission in the brain, and I'll slow that down a bit. GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid. That's not important. What is important is that it's the principal inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain. So it's the sort of the slowdown signal, slowing down rate of transmission across synapses. And alcohol essentially encourages that, encourages the actions of GABA, and basically indirectly then inhibits the brain.
Okay.
Leading to the nice, pleasant feeling initially. Also, the kind of giddy initial effect, because one of the first things that gets inhibited, you can kind of think of your brain is getting inhibited from the front to the back. And up front is kind of where judgment and good sense live. Breathing's kind of way back at down in the bottom. And that's the last thing to go. So, down in the brainstem.
Right.
So, up front is where we sort of live our social lives in terms of planning and organizing our activities and thinking about the future and thinking about consequences and should I say this to my boss. Then, of course, Christmas and New Year's parties are famous for all sorts of ordinarily forbidden or undesirable social interactions between coworkers or friends.
So when does that reduced inhibition and poor judgment begin? About how many glasses?
Well, that's a very good question. It would depend on how tolerant you are to alcohol. It would depend on how frequently you drink alcohol. And it would also depend on the social setting where you consume alcohol. Because what's interesting is there's actually been some research done with teenagers telling them they're getting alcohol and they're really just kind of getting nasty-tasting punch. And they get quite giddy and disinhibited, even though there's not a drop of alcohol in the room.
That is a bad 80s movie right there. Really? That they've done a study on that?
Believe it or not, yeah. So the social setting also seems to play a role, in addition to the direct intoxicating effects of the alcohol in combination with the vulnerability of an individual.
Interesting. Okay, well, how about when people get to that blackout point? What are their bodies doing then?
Right. Well, the blackout point means that you've now got enough alcohol on board that it's not only sort of greatly depressed your frontal lobe function, but is at the point where it is depressing temporal lobe function where the hippocampi live, and they are responsible for helping out. It's like the traffic directors of encoding long-term memory, and that implies a much more significant level of alcohol intoxication, as, you know, people who are in a blackout state or who later end up in a blackout state are the ones who are slurring their speech and stumbling around the floor. And so there's lots of system-wide gross impairment of sensory, motor, and cognitive functions.
So before we get to that blackout point, but maybe after that first drink, some people, they say that they think more clearly after that they've had that amount.
Well, you know, they probably do in some ways, because one of the big ways that we manage our social worlds is through little anxiety cues, like, hey, I really want to tell my boss how I feel about him. Then you kind of tense up a bit, and that's sort of inhibitory, like an inhibitory signal. And so you can kind of clear that out of the way, in a sense. And you might not be thinking more clearly. You might just be relaxed enough to actually notice what you're thinking about.
So part of this is, yes, and part of this is a psychological issue then.
Absolutely, sure. Because, of course, the earliest effects of alcohol, those first two glasses, that's the stuff, that's the part where you haven't got slurred speech yet, but maybe you're willing to go and talk to that cute guy in the corner or send a green light signal and tell him to get on over there.
But it's a, I'm going to say sometimes it's a fine line between those green light signals and the people dancing on the tables.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and of course, it's hard to predict when that's going to happen. In fact, it's just probably impossible to predict in any given individual. But of course, lots of statistical-based broad studies have looked at the issue of how many drinks to this, how many drinks to that. That's the sort of stuff that's seemingly well-known, because that stuff's out there. The police talk about it. Everyone talks about it. It's a simple matter of finding that kind of thing through Google. Like, gee, approximately as a male of my age and weight, how many drinks will it take before I'm an asshat?
Oh, okay. So this doesn't just have to do with your genetic predisposition.
Not at all, no. There are certainly strong genetic linkages, or at least genetic, what we would call heritability studies, looking at the likely concordance of alcoholism in identical twins raised apart, for instance. And most of these studies come out of Denmark, which seems to have the world's largest supply of identical twins raised apart.
But I've noticed that, actually.
Yeah. Part of that's really because Denmark actually just has a really fabulous birth registry system and collects all kinds of data. So it's a very handy place to go for studies. There's this gigantic database you can dredge. And so what we find is that there's certainly much more significant concordance between temperance, light drinking, moderate, heavy drinking, and all the way on up to full-on alcohol dependence in identical twins, less so in non-identical twins, less yet in just siblings, but stronger in siblings who have alcoholic parents. So there's clearly some genetic factor. What that is precisely, that's very hard to tell. It's even possible to tell because of the incredible mix of environmental and epigenetic factors that take you on down the track to being a fully developed adult.
So have there been studies done on alcohol tolerance and race? Because there's a lot of stereotypes around that.
Well, what's interesting is that one of the things that is known for sure is that the ability to break down alcohol is highly dependent on enzyme systems in the liver. And the specific group of subsystem is called the cytochrome P450 system, which is a kind of a marvel of evolutionary reverse engineering in plants. Plants use a variant of that system to make sugar from sunlight. We use it to detoxify alcohol and make metabolites. And one thing we do know is that in, say, for instance, individuals of Southeast Asian origin, they'll tend to have a lot less of the subsystems that are involved in alcohol metabolism. That's not necessarily restricted to Southeast Asians. This is going to be found with a varying frequency in any population. So this is going to be somebody who, when they have a drink, can quite rapidly kind of get that sort of flush, blush response and seem to be able to stay intoxicated for hours, you know, the so-called cheap date.
Right. What is this flush, blush that you just mentioned?
Oh, say you take those first few sips and get the big red cheeks right away.
I was assuming that's what you meant, but I wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
Making sure I wasn't missing something. So is all alcohol created equal? I'm just thinking, can different alcohol affect you differently?
Oh, yeah. And it's not the ethanol itself that does it. It's what we call the congeners, or the other stuff in there with the alcohol that gives it its taste, gives it its color, and just as a result of the brewing process. I mean, there's a reason that brandy is notorious for causing wicked hangovers. You know, an association noticed as far back as Samuel Johnson, or at least written about by him. And that's because, for instance, or what was thought to be, that brandy's just got a heck of a lot more methanol in it than other types of alcohol. And certainly lots of people find out on their own that five glasses of red wine is not the same as five glasses of white wine the next morning, right?
Right.
All the way down to things like vodka and pure ethanol, which, generally speaking, people seem to be able to tolerate quite large amounts of relative to their other brethren.
So just wondering, you know, you mentioned the brewing technique. So would mainstream breweries have a different effect than, for example, microbreweries?
Very good question. And that's one I would have to kind of punt over to a chemist. I'm not really sure what the differences would be in terms of the end result in that lovely microbrew beer versus something that falls off the line over at Labatt.
Well, there is the fact that they taste better. So that could, you know, increase your possibility of getting extensively drunk off that. Just a hypothesis, really. So you're in Vancouver, but I'm in Alberta, and it's quite cold. And when I'm at the pub, the people who go out in the cold to have a cigarette will sometimes seem fairly sober while they're outside, and then they come inside and they warm up a bit, and they're suddenly smashed. So
right.
is there any scientific rationale for that, or is that just confirmation bias on my part?
Well, that'd be a very interesting question to study. I don't know what the answer would be, but my guess would be it'd be something along the lines of the change in the social setting.
Hmm.
So when you're in an environment, sort of like back to our teenagers again, when you're in the environment and there's the expectation and the implied social license to engage in mild, moderate, or severe buffoonery, then you might go for that. Whereas if you're just outside smoking a cigarette, you're not getting any social feedback or social rewards. You're just a guy out there having a butt.
Right, and it's freezing also.
And it's freezing, so you want to get the heck back inside. So you're kind of mission-focused when it's minus 25.
Okay, that's, I think, also a reasonable hypothesis.
Yeah, thanks.
So let's talk about the result of all this debauchery, the inevitable hangover.
Yeah.
So why do we get hangovers?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the short answer is we don't know yet. We do know that there are whatever a hangover is, there's certainly been a lot of different factors identified with it. So one is that there's the dehydration. We do know that alcohol is a diuretic. It stops or slows down the production of certain hormones that keep your kidneys from going crazy. So those hormones aren't there, signaling the kidney, so the kidney starts to just let the gates rip. And then there's the often sort of mild hypoglycemic state, which can go along with the post-alcohol hangover state. Then there's a bit of what we call metabolic acidosis, meaning that the pH of your blood has dropped just a little bit, and so you're in a mildly acidic state, perhaps suitable for a pasta. And then there are the things we just don't have a clue about yet. Why do people get hangover headaches? Nobody knows. We do know that alcohol is a vasodilator, and it affects certain neurotransmitters involved with headache, such as dopamine, serotonin. But beyond that, it's really just guesswork. There's surprisingly little scientific data on hangovers. even though probably, again, coming back to Denmark, surveys of young Danish men have revealed that 73% of them at some point have had a hangover-induced headache, making it the most common cause of headaches among young men in Denmark. So just about everyone gets these things, and yet there's a surprising lack of scientific curiosity about them.
I find that interesting. Would a lot of these studies be self-reported studies? Is that the problem? Because I can't imagine an ethical study where someone would actually willingly want to do a hangover study. That sounds painful.
You know, it's funny you should say that, but there really are studies. It's not too hard to find strapping young college males willing to take the chance that they'll be the lucky one who doesn't get the hangover, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And then you feed them all different kinds of alcohol and see what happens. And that's where we kind of get some of the data on things like brandy versus red wine versus white wine versus beer versus spirits, that sort of thing. It's from these brave pioneers, these volunteers.
They're heroes, really.
Yeah. One thing we also have very scant evidence on is what to do about these things. Even as of the last review that I saw in the British Medical Journal in 2005 looked at the entire scientific literature, found 15 papers that reported different kinds of alcohol curative regimens. Seven of those papers had to be rejected because they didn't have proper comparators or a placebo control or an active control. And they found squat, like zip, zero diddly.
Really?
So the state of the science as of 2005 is that though there are many professed hangover cures, none of them work.
None of them? None?
None, zip, zero. I mean, there are, so the general rules of thumb is, well, okay, if you're dehydrated, well, replete yourself with fluids, right? If you are hypoglycemic, well, then get your blood sugar back. Maybe aspirin will help with the headache. But in terms of this hangover phenomenon, it's such a multi-headed hydra that it's not even really clear yet what we're dealing with, and it's also not clear what to do about it. And there's also some other really interesting data. The folk wisdom is that hangovers lead to a state of regret, which leads to a state of decreased alcohol consumption. But what's interesting is the data actually show that individuals with a predisposition toward alcoholism are often more likely to suffer worse hangovers. So it seems to be clearly refuted that having a bad hangover is going to reduce your consumption for alcohol, your taste for alcohol. In fact, the causation may flow quite the opposite direction. That's also with individuals with certain what we call sort of neurotic character traits, so defensiveness, tendency toward anger, tendency toward anxiety. Those folks, those personality traits seem to be associated with worse hangovers.
Interesting. Okay, so you're saying that the only potential way, and agreed, it could not cure it, but is hydration. It could alleviate it to some sense?
Maybe, sure.
You don't sound committed to that.
It's not bad to rehydrate yourself if you're dehydrated. It's certainly not bad to take some Tylenol if you have a headache. Are you actually curing the hangover, that sort of general awful feeling that kind of hangs around with you for hours and hours and hours? Maybe not. And then there's the other issues. Generally speaking, folks who have hangovers have also been deprived of a lot of sleep, and they feel tired and grumpy, but of course alcohol is notoriously bad for sleep duration and quality. And so what role is the lack of sleep playing? It's just simply impossible. The hangover may prove to be a more fundamental scientific mystery than consciousness itself, because we can't control different parts of a hangover and try to modify the variables one at a time. You're just sort of dealing with the whole thing, and you can never do blinded research about them either, because people know if they're hungover.
This is a far more complex issue than I had initially realized.
Complex and not, yeah.
Okay, now, there's something that I have heard since way back in the day The concept of the buffalo theory, have you heard this?
No.
Alcohol can only catch the slowest neurons. So drinking actually makes you smarter by killing off the dead weight. Culling the herd, one would say.
That just sounds like lunacy to me.
So there's nothing to that, hey? I didn't really think there was, but I was hoping. Killing off the slow brain cells, no?
Yeah, what's a slow neuron? That's an interesting idea, but of course, the actual detected firing rate has a lot more to do with the kind of signaling that the neuron's engaged in rather than its actual capacity. The vast majority of our neurons are running far slower than their stated capacity. We are horrendously underclocked. You know, we clock around 40 hertz, and we could actually, certain neurons in lab dishes can go up to 1 kilohertz.
You're just crushing my dreams. It's fine. So if you could leave our audience with one take-home message, what would that be?
Oh, I guess I would say don't worry too much about finding some miracle cure if you're having an awful day on New Year's. Just suck it up, Buttercup.
You have a way with words, sir.
Thank you.
And Rob, thank you so much for being on Skeptically Speaking.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
One of the neat things about science is that it's always discovering new things. You research, you do studies, you test theories, and sometimes you find out that you may have been wrong. On December 27th, 2009, a few weeks after we taped this episode, a new study was released on hangovers. The study, which will be published in Alcohol, Clinical and Experimental Research, followed 95 healthy adults who drank just enough liquor to get drunk and were surveyed the next day. Those who drank dark liquors like bourbon, red wine, brandy, and spiced rum were much more likely to report symptoms of a hangover than those who drank lighter colored alcohols such as white wine, vodka, and gin. However, those light-colored alcohol-drinking participants reported being just as unproductive the next morning as the individuals drinking darker liquors. The researchers attribute the results to the amount of chemicals in darker liquor. They note that while there are enough toxins and chemicals in all alcohol to make people feel hungover, studies have shown that dark liquors have up to 37 times more chemicals than light liquors. Thanks very much to Dr. Rob Tarswell for keeping us up to date.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including LP99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, CJAI 92.1 Amherst Island Radio Broadcasting Inc., and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. While I was researching this episode, I came across some interesting studies that I want to mention. First up, two studies published last year about teen brain development and alcohol. One was a U.S. study in the official journal of the EEG and Clinical Neuroscience Society, showing that alcohol has a stronger effect on teen brain development than marijuana. The other was a study published in The Lancet, offering the results of substance classification by a number of UK professionals, purporting that alcohol is more dangerous than marijuana to individuals and to society. So the U.S. study looked at teen brain development for its uniqueness as well as for the effects that substance abuse has on the brain. When the brain abnormalities were measured in terms of brain functioning and structure, cognitive tasks, and quality of white matter, it appeared as though alcohol had a greater effect than marijuana. Heavy drinking was defined at 20 drinks per month, and the abnormalities were detectable. In heavy marijuana users, abnormalities existed, but not to the same degree as those seen in the alcohol abusers. And that study supports what David Nutt at Bristol University found when he asked psychologists and scientifically or medically trained police to rank different substances according to how harmful they are. The study purports that experts rank alcohol and tobacco as more harmful than marijuana. In a list of 20 substances, alcohol came in at number 5, tobacco came in at number 9, and marijuana / cannabis came in at number 11. I make no judgment calls here, just reporting the studies. Next, squarely in the "these people received funding for this" category, is last year's Virginia Tech study on student alcohol consumption. It reports that students view their drinking as normal and acceptable despite the abundance of medical and social research to the contrary. It also notes the large and apparently unexpected consumption of alcohol preceding sporting events. In other news, the sky is blue. I also found an article on SciBlog on why loud music in bars increases alcohol consumption. In a 2008 study published in Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research, the researchers observed bar patrons' drinking habits across 3 Saturday nights in 2 different bars. The level of the music was randomly manipulated to create the conditions of a true experiment. It was either at its usual volume of 72 decibels or turned up to 88 decibels. And for comparison, 72 decibels is like the sound of traffic on a busy street, while 88 decibels is like standing next to a lawnmower. So when the music went up, the beers went down faster. On average, bargoers took 14.5 minutes to finish a 250 milliliter glass of draft beer when the music was at its normal level. But this came down to just 11.5 minutes when the music was turned up. As a result, on average, during their time at the bar, each participant ordered one more drink in the loud music condition than the normal music condition. The observers even measured the number of gulps taken to finish each drink. The level of the music was found to have no effect on this. So the faster drinking was as a result of more gulps rather than bigger gulps. And so the study doesn't tell us why this happens, although the article postulates that people drink more when there's less opportunity for conversation, while others have argued that they drink more because the music creates greater levels of arousal, which then leads to more drinking. And here's a study published in Addiction magazine in 2009, which looked at alcohol consumption in over 38,000 people in central Norway. It concluded that abstainers and heavy drinkers are more likely to be anxious or depressed than moderate drinkers. So the problem with most studies on alcohol and depression is that many teetotalers are former alcoholics, which means their former lifestyles may be the cause of their problems, not the fact that they don't drink. And it makes sense that swearing off alcohol after being a regular drinker could trigger depression, which may have skewed previous studies. But in this study, the researchers were able to separate the former alcoholics from the rest of the non-drinkers, and the non-drinkers were still at greater risk of anxiety and depression. So why would they be more at risk? Well, first, many people don't abstain by choice, but because they have to. If they're on medication for an illness, they may not be able to drink. And if it's a serious illness, that itself leads to depression. And add to that that teetotalers are also more likely to be socially excluded, reporting having fewer friends than moderate drinkers. The pressure to drink, in our culture, is pervasive and persistent. The researchers say that these effects, former alcoholics, being ill, and social exclusion, explain some of the increased risk to abstainers, but not all of it. They also note that the problems are most pronounced in people who actually label themselves as abstainers. People who don't drink, but don't call themselves abstainers, are less at risk.
Why that should be is so far unclear. And last, I have a study showing a strong link between alcohol and cycling deaths. Autopsies of bike accident victims in New York City have shown that about 21% had been drinking, according to a study published in the April 2009 edition of Traffic Injury Prevention. Studies from other cities have shown similar patterns. And so there's probably kind of a lesson here, but I'm not exactly sure what that is. Perhaps just that being environmentally friendly and health conscious still leaves room for you to be an idiot in other areas of your life? That and this season, watch out for drunken cyclists. So let's go from how alcohol hurts you to how it can help. Over the years, we've been bombarded with research about how alcohol is good for your heart. But then another study came out that said it was bad for your heart. And then another that said that there was a higher incidence of throat cancers in drinkers. And then it was red wine was good for your back, and then your memory, and then it was bad for your memory. So it's all very confusing. Next up, we'll be talking to Dr. Kenneth McCamal, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He researches the effects of lifestyle factors, particularly alcohol consumption, on the development and prognosis of cardiovascular and other chronic diseases. Some good news, perhaps? Let's have a listen. So, Ken, you've been part of a number of studies showing that moderate drinkers have a lower rate of heart attacks than abstainers. Can you tell us about some of them?
Sure. And indeed, I think ours fit very well into a larger body of studies, I think probably 100 or so, that have, in general, I think, found very consistently that individuals who drink moderately, and typically when we say moderately, we're talking about something in the range of one drink every couple of days up to about two drinks per day, have lower rates of heart disease than do people who drink, who don't drink at all, and that the lower risk is about 25% lower risk, depending on the study. We've looked at a variety of different populations. So we've looked at men, we've looked at women, we've looked at middle age, and we've looked at older adults, and pretty much all of them, we tend to see about the same thing. We generally find that, to the extent that we've been able to look at this, that what seems to matter the most is the frequency with which people drink, meaning that what seems to confer lower risk is that pattern of drinking where people are drinking regularly, small amounts, but not the quantity. So there's no benefit to going out and drinking six or seven drinks at a time. The lowest risk seems to be amongst individuals who are drinking even pretty small amounts, anywhere from 3 to 4 days a week on up.
So why is that? What benefit does alcohol have?
I suppose that there are two schools of thought on this, and in fairness to one school, one possibility is that it's all nonsense, I suppose. That the reason for this is because moderate drinkers differ in some ways than non-drinkers do. And so, you know, that's a possibility, and we can talk a little bit more about that. But from a biological standpoint, we actually have a few pretty concrete mechanisms that we think are likely to explain this. And these come from randomized experiments. So these are, you know, classic studies where we take people and we randomly assign them to either drink or not drink for a few weeks on end and see what happens to their blood and blood markers. The by far best defined health effect of alcohol in these sorts of studies is on HDL cholesterol, high density lipoprotein cholesterol. That's the good cholesterol that you hear about and that you get measured by your physician. And HDL is associated with a lower risk of heart disease, and alcohol raises it. And we think that by raising HDL, that may actually produce more of these HDL particles that pull cholesterol out of plaques and out of our arteries. So that's probably the best defined way. We know that alcohol very strongly raises HDL. In fact, it probably raises it better than anything else that we have. And we know that in statistical models, when you look at studies like ours, about half of the benefit, or in some cases even two-thirds of the benefit of alcohol, seems to be related to the higher levels of HDL that the drinkers have. There are a few other mechanisms that are perhaps less, that are, you know, I think sort of still being worked out, but have some very promising science behind them. One of those is an effect of alcohol on blood sugar. And although we tend to think of alcohol as particularly being associated with low risk of heart disease, it turns out that to a great extent, the evidence is almost as strong that alcohol may prevent diabetes, and again, at moderate doses only. And we think that appears to be because, again, in these randomized trials, that people who are given alcohol respond to insulin better. They have less insulin resistance than when people are given a controlled beverage without alcohol.
I haven't actually heard that. Is this a recent finding?
There have been trials like this over several years. One of the largest was conducted at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I already know a few years ago. That one took about 50 or 60 postmenopausal women and sequentially, but randomly, had them either drink what in essence was Kool-Aid or Kool-Aid with alcohol of varying levels. And during the periods of time when women were taking larger amounts of alcohol, their ability to respond to insulin improved. There's been a couple of more recent trials that maybe haven't got as much press, in part because they've been conducted overseas. The longest trial that's ever been conducted to date on alcohol took a group of patients in Italy who were diabetic and had recently suffered heart attacks, and for a year gave them advice. So they didn't give them any alcohol, but they gave them advice. And half of the group, they gave the advice to drink red wine every day, which is probably easy to give Italians. And the other half, they gave advice not to drink alcohol at all. I suppose that's probably only possible to say to diabetic Italians. Regardless, they followed them for about a year, and I think they may still be following them. But at a year, the individuals who were told to drink red wine not only had lower levels of inflammation in their body and slightly better measures of blood sugar control, but their heart function was actually better, we're not exactly sure why that might be, but it was, this was seen in a randomized experiment. And then lastly, there's a study done amongst diabetics for about, which is the largest, excuse me, the longest study that's been done so far. That took about 100 diabetics in Israel, and they were randomly assigned either to drink something with alcohol or not over a period of 3 months. And during that time period, the individuals who drank alcohol had better blood sugar than those who didn't. So we've now actually got a series of studies, I think, that are kind of giving us the same message.
Okay, well, I started out wanting to talk about heart health and alcohol, but there seems to be a lot of link with just good health and alcohol.
It's to some degree that's true, but I should be fair in saying that there are health risks even from moderate drinking as well. And as a primary care physician, I think it's important to think about those broadly. The most important one clearly is breast cancer. So women who drink even moderately, again, have a higher risk of breast cancer, probably in the range of about 10 to 15% higher for every drink per day that they have. So it's not an enormously higher risk, but it's important. And it, in some respect, sort of counterbalances some of what we know about heart disease. That, on the one hand, there's some benefits, on the other hand, there are some risks, and trying to integrate those in some way, can be difficult.
So agreed, you couldn't say that alcohol overall is better, but for certain specific things, it does have a positive effect.
Yeah, I think that's right, that there's really sort of a complex mixture of effects that we've seen in studies, some of which are good and some of which are bad, as it were. And, so there's a higher risk, say, of breast cancer, but a lower risk of heart disease. And then trying to tease those apart and for an individual doctor and for individual drinkers, these are somewhat difficult decisions to make. It's trying to balance kind of what's my risk for breast cancer, what's my risk for heart disease or diabetes or other things. So it does get complicated. I think there are a couple of themes that can carry through though. One of which is, as I said, that we do see benefits on HDL cholesterol, and we see benefits on blood sugar. And so those would be expected to improve things like diabetes and heart disease, so diseases sort of related to the developed world and obesity and things. We also see, interestingly, effects of alcohol on sex steroids, so a class of hormones that are particularly related to things like estrogen. So you might expect, if we're doing things like raising estrogen with alcohol, that we might lead to breast cancer, and indeed we do. You might also expect that that might have something to do with our bones, because you know women have at least in the past been prescribed hormones to improve bone density, and indeed that's been seen with alcohol as well, that moderate drinkers tend to have better bone density than do non-drinkers. And again, so there's sort of, I think, a common theme there relating to the mechanism being sex steroid hormones. And then lastly, alcohol has an interesting sort of blood thinning effect. And that's been known really for quite a while, for probably 30 years. And you might expect if alcohol is a bit of a blood thinner that you tend to have fewer clots. And indeed, so things like certain types of strokes or heart attacks seem to be lower in moderate drinkers. But on the other hand, you might expect that there might be more bleeding if you are thinning people's blood. And indeed, hemorrhagic strokes or strokes in which there's bleeding into the brain are higher amongst moderate drinkers. So there's this sort of complex calculus of effects related to moderate drinking. But at least to my eye, they seem to fit into a few themes related to something that we know about the biology.
Is the effect of alcohol on your heart or diabetes or whatever the case, something that changes with race or weight or gender by any chance?
All interesting questions. Let me tackle the gender one first and say we seem to find lower risk of at least heart disease regardless of the gender. And for the most part, the effect seems to be at least as strong in women as in men. Now, women have lower rates of heart disease in general, so the same amount of benefit in a woman may not help her as much as in a man, but in general, that seems to be the case. However, there's an important difference in that the benefits, as it were, of alcohol in women seem to occur at lower doses, and that would fit with the idea that women have, in general, smaller bodies, and also that they don't metabolize alcohol as well as men do. And so, for example, standard limits to drinking are typically 2 drinks a day for a man and 1 drink a day for a woman. And that fits very nicely with what we see in terms of the lower risk of heart disease, that the lower risk of heart disease seems to come earlier to women than to men in terms of smaller doses. Obviously, some things like breast cancer are really only a risk for women and not a risk for men. So in general, the gender pieces are similar, you know, for those diseases, you know, that are common to both sexes. Race is a really interesting one, and I don't think we know as much about this as ideally we would. There have been sort of somewhat inconsistent findings, I'd say, in this regard. Almost every study that's been done in whites has found lower risk. But studies, at least in African Americans, have been mixed. And there's been interesting findings from a study called Interheart that looked at risk of heart disease around the world. And in that very large study, moderate drinking was associated with lower risk of heart disease worldwide. But interestingly, in Africa, it seemed to be associated with lower risk amongst white Africans and amongst so-called mixed race Africans, as that study put it, but not amongst black Africans. And it suggests that there may be some genetic differences in how alcohol is metabolized, perhaps, that don't make it as protective, as it were, amongst some races as others. I think we need to do a little bit more about that, and there's certainly studies ongoing in this regard. But I think that's one area where I'm not sure that we know how to generalize just yet.
Now, also in some of the studies that I was looking at, there was a comparison between beer and wine and such. So is there a difference in a positive effect based on the alcohol?
So a great question. The very kind of common wisdom is that there must be something about red wine, which says it. And at least in our experience, we feel, I think, that there's nothing special about the type of beverage. And there's a couple of reasons why. That is to say that it doesn't have to be red wine, but it's the alcohol itself. First, we know that alcohol itself raises HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol. So it doesn't have to be red wine. Beer and spirits do it just as well. And in studies that have compared different beverages, it's the alcohol that really matters. So the mechanism seems to be related to alcohol itself. Secondly, a lot of the studies that have sort of suggested that red wine might be best have come from red wine drinking countries, places like Italy or France.
Right.
And in fact, in our work, amongst, say, the health professionals in the U.S., beer and spirits were the ones that were most strongly associated with lower risk, not red wine. Red wine was least associated. Our interpretation of that is because it turns out that red wine is the beverage that men drink least frequently. So going back to the idea that it's the frequency with which people drink that dictates lower risk for heart disease, it's not the beverage that matters, but it's the beverage that's consumed frequently that matters. So that's sort of been, those are at least, I think, two lines of evidence that sort of point to that. It is true that in animals, if you take certain compounds from red wine, those compounds themselves have health benefits. The problem is that to get enough of those compounds to equal what these mice are getting, you would need to drink liters and liters and liters of wine a day. So it's, you know, there may very well be benefits, special benefits to red wine, but I don't think at the doses that people are normally drinking them at.
Okay, now you were talking about excessive drinking, but is it possible that the amount a person drinks could be associated with other types of behaviors that could also be causes of the results? For example, excessive drinkers could conceivably be more likely to have a poor diet?
Well, it's an interesting question. And there actually has been some thought about that. It brings to mind some work that Rodney Jackson in New Zealand has done. And his group was involved with doing studies of alcohol consumption and heart disease very early on. And he recently sort of argued that we're probably overstating some of the benefits of light drinking because of this problem that light drinkers differ from non-drinkers in lots of ways, and the light drinkers are probably very healthy people. But at the same time, we may be underestimating the benefits of heavy drinking, at least for heart disease, just heart disease alone, because heavy drinkers, for instance, tend to smoke. So to some degree may have a poor diet or other things. So that it may be that while at the same time there's not as much benefit to light drinking as we sometimes ascribe to there being, that heavy drinking may be associated with lower risk of heart disease at least as much. Now, with that being said, when you start getting into the amounts of, we start getting above three drinks or more per day. So I'll use that as kind of a cut point for heavy drinking. It's very clear that you begin to see higher rates of death from alcohol-related illnesses. So things like liver cirrhosis, so things like high blood pressure, certain types of cancers. So that number, around three drinks per day, seems reasonably to define a threshold at which, even if there is a benefit to heart disease above that, it begins to get counterbalanced by harms to other organs.
I think we need a formula to be able to work this out.
Yeah. It would be a pretty complex formula, and in part because of this idea that I think everybody sort of has a different threshold. It's one reason why I think it's been difficult to make, recommendations about drinking. And to my knowledge, there really hasn't been any systematic effort, even in governmental agencies, both in the U.S. and Canada, that have looked at this question to say, gee, this subset of people ought to start drinking, because they're at really high risk for heart disease and their HDL is really low and maybe they would get some benefit. The problem is that there's so many of these things that it affects, and frankly, it could go on longer. It's hard to, it's hard to balance those. It's hard to say, well, gee, for person X, you ought to be drinking, but for person Y who looks very similar but say has a higher risk for breast cancer, you shouldn't be drinking. So you would, the equation would have to look pretty complicated, and frankly, if I can be pretty honest, speaking as a primary care doctor, I don't think most primary care doctors are really interested in doing it, just because it's so complicated. And so, we pretty much get the same old, get the same advice from almost everybody, which is it's okay to drink a little bit, but don't drink more than the standard limits. And if you're taking a whole bunch of medications, then don't drink at all.
Do you sometimes think that maybe you don't want to talk to the media about these kind of studies because it would seem as if you were promoting drinking?
I think that there's a lot of concern about that. We've been lucky in that our particular group has been funded so far only by the U.S. National Institutes of Health and by the American Heart Association. And so we haven't been put in a position ourselves where we've, you know, we've received money from the alcohol industry or anything, but other groups have. And in part because it's, you know, I mean, it is a convenient way to get research done, I suppose. So, and in those situations, you know, once people have taken money from the alcohol industry, it's very easy to label everything that they do as being industry biased, even if in many cases those folks were saying the same thing before they ever took money from the industry. But it, you know, the general idea that, you know, gee, we want to be careful about saying that alcohol is good for you, I think is fair. I don't, in part because I'm a primary care doctor and I see, you know, to some degree the benefits, but I also see the harms. I see people who fell down because they had too much to drink. I see people who've had breast cancer. I see people who've had you know, strokes that where they bled into their brain. And so, you know, trying to manage all those together, I think, is really important. And as I said, you know, I think it's hard to come up with a simple prescription that would fit across the whole population. With all that being said, there certainly are some folks in the States, and I would say particularly cardiologists, who aren't really abashed about saying, you know, we think a little bit of drinking is good for you, and we recommend it. In part, that's because, you know, those are cardiologists, and they're particularly focused on the organ that alcohol probably helps. But just, I think more generally, they're looking at, you know, sort of a narrower spectrum of the potential harms, and I think we'd like to be careful about that.
Well, I honestly can't believe I got away with saying that potentially excessive drinking could be positive in any way. So I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that there's probably little to no health benefit associated with binge drinking. Correct? I'm asking this on the off chance that this also could be
beneficial. Well, let me go back and say that, you know, that for heavy drinking, and I'm gonna here sort of call heavy drinking, say 3 to 4 to 5 drinks a day, say, that, you know, if there's benefit to it, it's on one particular thing only. And so it's not as though the net benefit is there even for that. I think it's pretty clear that the sweet spot, as it were, for drinking is somewhere in the range of a half to one drink a day. If you look at studies of mortality, of just overall, you know, who lives and who dies, that seems to be kind of where the sweet spot is. So everything above that is potentially associated with higher mortality. Binge drinking seems to be a pretty much no-win situation. We're not really aware of any, I can't think of any benefit to it. And I can think of a lot of harms to it. We've seen just certainly risks of things like, you know, increasing your blood pressure acutely, probably even triggering heart attacks acutely, although that hasn't been as well studied. Certainly triggering heart rhythm disturbances acutely, so things like atrial fibrillation. And then, frankly, there's really, really, really big concerns related to violence, suicide, homicide, rape, you know, related to inebriation and binge drinking. So it's hard to come up with a lot of good things on that end. And again, the idea that even for the heart benefit, you know, there's really no benefit to binge drinking. You can get kind of all the benefit, as it were, for the heart with even, you know, one drink, you know, every other day. So you don't need to drink very much to get what we think is any benefit with really no risk of harm or very little risk of harm.
So we're almost out of time. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
You know, with all of that being said, we're currently now starting a very small trial ourselves, because I think the one thing that's missing from the package that I just that we've tried to put together, and I think the package is kind of compelling, but the one thing that's missing is good old fashioned randomized trial evidence that, gee, we took 10,000 people, and half of them we gave alcohol to, and half of them we didn't, and we followed them for 10 years, and we saw what happened. Now, that kind of study is probably not possible to do. It's very difficult, I can tell you from personal experience, to get people who drink regularly to be willing to stop drinking for 10 years. And it's pretty difficult to get people who don't drink very much to agree to drink every day for 10 years. So I'm not sure this is possible. But with that being said, you know, that piece is missing. And as, you know, there's been some, I think, pretty well-described examples of things like vitamin E or hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women, to say, you know, sometimes what we think in these observational studies and even in the small feeding studies that we've done doesn't always pan out when you do those kinds of trials. Now, most of the time it still does pan out, to be fair, but it doesn't always. So I think that's, you know, the one big hole in what we've been doing. And we're hoping that we can start trying to do this. But, you know, as of now, we just don't know. And it's not entirely clear that will ever get the kind of advice. And so we're sort of stuck as of today, both as doctors and patients, as it were, and public health professionals, kind of dealing with the best advice that we have. But the fact is that we don't have the kind of ideal advice, or excuse me, the ideal evidence with which to make advice that we might. So someday we may get that, but in the interim, you know, this is the best we've got.
And thank you so much for doing studies like this. You've successfully alleviated some guilt for some people and potentially scared the crap out of others.
Probably the way it ought to be, I think. Certainly some people on both ends of the spectrum that we'd like to get to move toward the middle, I guess, as it were. And, you know, because it's such a, you know, for me, and I think just for many people in general, you know, it's such a common thing that people are exposed to. People are drinking every day all over the world. And because it's got so many different effects on so many different parts of us, you know, it remains a really interesting thing to study for, you know, hopefully years to come.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Ken.
You bet.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking to author and physicist Aaron Santos about his new book, How Many Licks? Have you ever wondered how many calories are in a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man? How many licks it takes to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? How long it would take you to dig your way to China using a spoon? Aaron knows. And he'll be calculating, live on air, your most random and obscure mathematical questions. If you can't listen live next week, send an email to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or submit your question through the website. You'll find this valuable public service only on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Just something to mention, we post information about the upcoming episode on skepticallyspeaking.com every Saturday. So if you can't listen live, but you have questions about the topic, you can submit them all week through the website. Also on the site is the comments section for this episode, as well as links for our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks very much for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government.